is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And our This Day in History is about a man that's been vilified by some, described as a robber baron, as worse. But today, you'll get the record straight. The life of a man you know his name, but here's the other side of the story.
It was the 1800s. And in just 35 short years, America had grown into one of the most powerful countries on the planet, fueled by a group of visionaries who were building a better future. Cornelius Vanderbilt stopped at nothing to connect the nation via railroads. John D. Rockefeller lit homes from coast to coast, cheaply and safely with his Standard Oil. Under the strength of Andrew Carnegie's steel, cities expanded to the sky, and bridges tightened a nation. And because of J.P. Morgan's business sense and vision, electricity began powering America. But what exactly did J.P. Morgan do? And why is it that we all know this man's name?
You look at J.P. Morgan, the way he controlled the banking system. Basically, there's one man who just literally dominated the banking industry and essentially dominated financing in the country.
J.P. was a banker, a very powerful one, who pulled the financial strings of wealthy men and was called on by presidents for what we now know as a bailout. He was a man who brought order to chaos, a man who made a fortune consolidating broken industries, buying out failing companies, and returning them to profitability. Twice he was called on by American presidents to save the nation's economy. Both times he was criticized for wielding the power for the ability to do so. He was physically large, with massive shoulders, piercing black eyes that seemed to look through people. He had an enormously disfigured purple nose because of a chronic skin condition called rosacea. As a result, all of his professional portraits were retouched. Photographer Edward Steichen said, "Meeting his blazing dark eyes was like confronting the headlights of a freight train bearing down on you." There is so much to say about this man, but as you are about to see, America wasn't discovered. It was built. In 1837, the new steam engine was beginning to transform America, creating new and exciting opportunities. It was into this world of possibility that John Pierpont Morgan was born on April 17th in Hartford, Connecticut. The eldest son of Junius Spencer Morgan, the legendary founder of the world's first modern investment bank, and Juliet Pierpont Morgan, the daughter of a fiery preacher. Young Pierpont was greatly influenced by both his grandfathers. Every Sunday, he accompanied his grandfather, Joseph Morgan, to the local Episcopal church. Pierpont loved the services, especially when it came to singing the hymns. His other grandfather, the Reverend John Pierpont, was known for his passionate sermons on man's depravity and the love of Christ. Here's historian Ron Chernow.
From his Pierpont grandfather, Morgan got a streak of romanticism, a streak of morality, and even a certain crusading streak that would be very important in his life.
From the time he could count, Pierpont was taught that there was only one way to do business, the Morgan way. Simply put, invest wisely, avoid risk. Pierpont was a relatively solitary child who preferred reviewing his father's account books to outdoor sports.
I will return tonight. See that these accounts balance by then.
From a very young age, Junius had Pierpont working his books and imagining a bright future for himself.
Go ahead, open it. Now pick it up. Feel the weight. You know what that is? That's what it feels like to hold $1 million. Now, learn to earn it yourself.
Pierpont's father noticed his son's abilities and over the years groomed him for a career in business.
He raised his son Pierpont with a great deal of love, but also a great deal of discipline. Junius Spencer Morgan expected that his son would follow in his footsteps and succeed in the business world.
But illness plagued Pierpont and often kept him out of school.
From the time that he was a boy, he really had two personalities. One was this very jolly, animated, high-spirited, outgoing boy with tremendous energy and health. But then he would suddenly get these fainting spells, and that was accompanied by a personality that was more that of a brooding loner.
Forced by illness to spend time alone, Pierpont perfected the game of solitaire, a game he played to relax when he felt tense or nervous. After his first year at college, Pierpont's father decided it was time for his 20-year-old son to begin his career and arranged for him to be given a job as a clerk in a Wall Street banking firm. He worked hard, was orderly and absolutely methodical, and he could add numbers with lightning speed. Here's historian H.W. Brands.
J.P. Morgan understood the game, and at some point he realized that as successful as his father had been, he could become even more successful.
At this time, Pierpont was introduced to a young lady named Amelia Sturgis, or Mimi, and they began dating. Soon Pierpont was sent to New Orleans, where he stumbled upon a business opportunity that he couldn't resist. A local sea captain was stuck with a shipload of coffee and no buyer. Immediate action was required, or the coffee would spoil. Using the firm's money, Pierpont purchased the coffee and managed to turn a tidy little profit in the process. In New York, the partners at the bank weren't impressed. They were angry and thought the venture was risky. But Morgan believed that fortune smiles on those who act fast, and he believed his instincts about people would always make him a winner.
He said the real risk was that he had misjudged the character of the captain and that the captain would have lied to him. And this is sort of the quintessential issue of Morgan, that he was able to look at people and immediately make a judgment of their character and of their integrity, and one of his greatest strengths.
And that is a real talent. When we come back, more of this exceptional life, a misunderstood life, a misrepresented life, the life of J.P. Morgan. And this is Our American Stories. This Day in History, brought to us as always by Hillsdale College. More about Hillsdale in the next segment. But let's continue with this remarkable story about a misunderstood and amazing American life story, the life of J.P. Morgan.
Then, during the summer of 1861, 3 years after they had met, Mimi was diagnosed with tuberculosis, almost always fatal in the 19th century. Pierpont was devastated. Immediately, he took control of the situation. He proposed to Mimi, promising her that he'd help find a cure.
He married her in the family house in New York. In fact, he had to carry her downstairs for the ceremony.
Pierpont immediately took Mimi to Algiers for their honeymoon. He thought the tropical climate might save her. When Mimi's condition worsened, he brought in the best specialists to attend to her. But his efforts were in vain. 4 months after their marriage, on February 17th, 1862, Mimi died in Pierpont's arms.
Here's an extraordinary outpouring of somebody trying to control life in some way. It was a terrible loss for him, and he failed. But he knew what he was getting into, oddly enough. He was daring, and almost he was daring death in some sort of dramatic way, and attempting to control it.
The ordered, controlled life that Pierpont had made for himself was turned upside down. He returned to New York a changed man.
The loss was so powerful that, in a way, it forced him to keep his genuinely emotional nature under tight control.
Pierpont immersed himself in his business. He also remembered the comfort he received while attending church as a young boy. He joined St. George's Church in Manhattan and became an active member. As he continued to grieve for Mimi, the church provided a type of redemption that Pierpont didn't expect. It was there where he met the young, beautiful Fanny Tracy. She was at first put off by Pierpont's gruff demeanor, but soon she warmed to his affections. After a year-long courtship, Pierpont and Fanny were married at St. George's Church on May 31st, 1865. They had three daughters and one son. Pierpont's prospects were bright. At 33, he had a beautiful family, a yacht, two homes, and was earning more than $75,000 a year, a huge amount in a time when $2,000 was a comfortable living. Then, like the discovery of fire and the invention of the wheel, Morgan envisioned electric light revolutionizing the world. Morgan hired Thomas Edison, a telegraph boy turned inventor, to install electricity at his Manhattan mansion on 219 Madison Avenue, the first electrically lit home in the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, behold the miracle of modern science. The gas lamp is dead. Long live the electric light. Every light you see is powered by electricity.
Morgan's home became a lab for Edison's experiments. And when the time came to showcase electric light to a group of potential investors, Pierpont's father was not impressed.
Well, Father, what do you think?
You disappoint me, Pierpont. I thought you knew better.
This is the future.
This is the stuff of carnivals and fairs. And you've been played for a fool.
Though his father, Junius, saw electric light as a risky fad, Morgan invested everything in Edison. In the end, the fruits of Morgan's insight and investment gave birth to a company called General Electric. At this point, Morgan was running the biggest investment bank in America and consolidated both the electricity and railroad industries. He controlled 100,000 miles of railroad, half the country's mileage. But the American economy was fragile, and in 1893, the stock market crashed. The nation was thrown into a devastating depression. More than 100 railroads declared bankruptcy, causing a domino effect that threatened other businesses and promised complete collapse of the economy. As had happened in the past, powerful men called upon Pierpont Morgan to bail them out.
My railroad will survive. We'll win this war.
We need an answer.
Do you want to come to war?
I've heard enough. This is what's going to happen. There's going to be an end to this war. The Morgan Bank will buy the West Shore and lease it to the Central. It'll also buy the Central stake in the South Pennsylvania in exchange for a share in other railroads.
He excelled at taking warring parties who were destroying an industry and bringing peace on terms that was suitable to them, profitable to him, and which gave him leverage in the business itself. Anyone who knew anything about him realized that, like him or not, he got things done.
Morgan reorganized the railroads by streamlining operations, and he was quickly able to reverse the downward spiral. But Pierpont wasn't finished. As a result of the Depression of 1893, the federal government's gold reserves had dropped to such an alarmingly low level that it looked as though the United States government would go broke. Fortunately, writes Phil Anschutz, Morgan considered the United States too big to fail. So Morgan devised a plan in which American and European bankers would invest gold directly in the government, saving it from collapse. But President Cleveland rejected Morgan's plan, and instead he backed a plan to raise the money by selling bonds directly to the public. But Morgan knew that the government didn't have time to sell bonds. Morgan quickly took a train to Washington, but was told that the president would not see him. Morgan's reply was swift. I have come down to Washington, D.C. to see the president, and I'm going to stay here until I see him.
I think Pierpont Morgan certainly felt that he was the equal of the president of the United States.
The next morning, word came from the White House that Morgan would be received. The president implemented Morgan's plan, and within days, the economy recovered. Here's Alan Greenspan.
Morgan obviously was looking at the national interest in the context of his own. That is, saving the U.S. Treasury was an act of basic self-interest, but it was an act of nationalism.
Morgan was hailed as a hero. He was praised for his patriotism and selflessness. But like all good deeds, Morgan's didn't go unpunished. Some accused him of manipulating the government and collecting a profit.
People began to decide that Pierpont had too much power to be able to save the government of the United States. It's an extraordinary thing. And therefore, the only way that he could have done it is by having some sort of evil capability.
With the chaos, uncertainty, and personal demonization that often plagued Morgan's life, there was one source of stability: St. George's Church. The Reverend Rainsford said, "Sometimes I found him kneeling in prayer, or reading, or singing a hymn without organ and alone. No one but myself knew that the great master of men and things was worshiping." But this great master of men and things had another side. Morgan was known for enormous appetites.
He consumed enormous quantities of port, sherry, and wine with dinner. He had breakfast so large they could have killed a horse.
His appetites extended to other areas as well. He was often seen in the company of women other than his wife.
Pierpont once made a very telling comment that there are always two reasons why a man does something, a good reason and the real reason. And he was always very respectful of Fanny. He was very discreet about the various escapades that he went through.
And it just keeps getting more interesting, the life of J.P. Morgan. You've heard the name, you've heard the firm, but now you know the story behind the story, and there's more. It gets even better. I mean, that one man can almost save a country by himself is pretty remarkable. When we come back, more of the life of J.P. Morgan on This Day in History, brought to you, as always, by Hillsdale College. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And by the way, so many of the voices you're hearing in this piece are from some of the best people in the world of finance and storytelling in U.S. history. Ron Chernow wrote the book, The House of Morgan. You've heard from him several times. You heard from Alan Greenspan, former Federal Reserve Chairman, who talked about the fact that Morgan operated not only in his self-interest, but in the national interest at the same time. He did both. And so now let's return to this remarkable life story. And as always, this day in history segment is brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. Let's get back to the story.
Morgan's passionate nature extended to his business enterprises. In 1901, he undertook the largest business transaction in modern history, the purchase of Carnegie Steel. Morgan knew he couldn't negotiate directly with Andrew Carnegie. He needed another way in. So he set up a meeting with Carnegie's right-hand man, Charles Schwab.
How long have you worked for Carnegie?
Over 15 years.
I guess he'd hate it if you left.
No one is indispensable.
You've doubled profits at Carnegie Steel every year for the past 5 years.
Times have been good. Carnegie's a very easy boss.
What if you were your own boss?
Of what?
I am going to buy Carnegie Steel. And you are going to be president of the world's largest company.
With all due respect, Mr. Morgan, Carnegie would kill your idea at birth. Carnegie would never sell.
Everyone has their price. You just have to find out what it is.
Carnegie Steel was the crown jewel in the Morgan Empire. When asked to name his price, Andrew Carnegie jotted down a figure on the back of an envelope.
Carnegie wasn't going to do any price haggling with Morgan. Carnegie writes down $480 million on a piece of paper. It's the equivalent of $400 billion today, more than Gates and Buffett together.
Carnegie dared J.P. Morgan to buy him out for an outrageous price. A sum that is higher than the entire budget of the U.S. federal government. Schwab returned to Morgan.
I have a price.
Have Carnegie come and meet me. Tell him the answer is yes.
Morgan and Carnegie solidified the deal.
I believe that that is the earliest in the day that I have ever drunk champagne.
Congratulations, Carnegie. You're now the richest man in the world.
Would you have said yes, Morgan, if I had asked for 100 million more?
Goodbye, Carnegie.
The deal was closed without lawyers and without a written contract. The agreement gave Carnegie a personal net worth of over $310 billion in today's money. The largest private fortune the modern world has ever seen. With Carnegie Steel under his belt, Morgan formed the United States Steel Corporation in March of 1901. Stock was valued at $1.4 billion. Morgan had created the world's first billion-dollar corporation. But his enormous power now brought public scrutiny.
After his creation of U.S. Steel, he controlled somewhere between 60 and 70% of the American steel industry. He controlled a third of American railways at a time when railway stocks comprised 60% of all the stocks on the New York Stock Exchange.
Morgan had reached the pinnacle of his power, and it looked as if nothing could stop him.
This is William Jennings Bryan at a recent Democrat rally. He's a prohibitionist and a devout Presbyterian. According to him, Darwin's theory of evolution is a pack of lies. He's an enemy of the gold standard and an enemy of big business. It is certain that he will win the Democratic nomination. What do you think?
The Republican Party has a good candidate.
No. We have to buy our own president.
At the turn of the century, Morgan, along with John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie, joined forces in launching the business-friendly William McKinley into the position of President of the United States. But on September 6th, 1901, McKinley was cut down by an assassin's bullet and died 8 days later. Vice President Theodore Roosevelt was sworn in as the next president.
Theodore Roosevelt, raise your right hand. Do you, Theodore Roosevelt, solemnly swear that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and to the best of your ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
And thus I swear. Now, let's get started.
Morgan soon confronted a man whose power equaled his own.
He was an unknown entity, but to the extent that people in New York knew his record, they also knew that he was something of a loose cannon who had gone on record as criticizing businessmen.
Roosevelt was determined to break up the big, powerful businesses called trusts, and he used Morgan's railroad company to set the example.
Morgan demanded to see the president, so he stormed down from New York to Washington, went into the White House, and he said, "I don't understand." He said, "If we've got a problem, send your man to my man and they'll fix it up." And Roosevelt said, "This is exactly the problem with Morgan. He acts as though I'm just a rival boss or something." And Morgan, who thought that he could manipulate Roosevelt, discovered that Roosevelt could not be manipulated at all.
Morgan was not impressed.
Pierpont Morgan resented Theodore Roosevelt, finally. And once when he heard that Roosevelt was going off to Africa on a safari, Morgan said, "Good, I hope the first lion that meets him does his duty."
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. A showdown, Roosevelt versus J.P. Morgan. It doesn't get better than this, folks, and we don't sugarcoat our this days in history. We don't romanticize the people. Warts and all, we tell the story. Sometimes you actually get to hear the upside of the man and not just the downside. But Roosevelt, well, he was there to do one thing. And it was not just bust that railroad trust. He wanted to make a name for himself as a trust buster, period. And when we come back, we're going to get the rest of this story. Again, our This Day in History, we're featuring the life of J.P. Morgan. Our source material, Out Where the West Begins by Phil Anschutz, a terrific chapter on J.P. Morgan. The House of Morgan, Ron Chernow's superb book, written in the 1980s, his first. And I don't know if it'll ever be topped, even though he's written Hamilton, the great book upon which the play is based. And, of course, a stunning biography of George Washington. When we come back, more of the life of J.P. Morgan here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and you can catch all of our This Days in History at OurAmericanNetwork.com. Go up to the topics section, and right up there on the top is This Day in History. We got 77 of them there. This one will make 78. More after these messages. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And our This Day in History segment is focused on one life for the hour. We don't do many hours on business people, but we're going to be doing more because just as George Washington deserves an hour, just as John Wooden does, just as Martin Luther King does, what we haven't done enough of in this country is celebrate our great business people who changed the country. And all of these guys are flawed characters, just like all of our founding fathers, just like Martin Luther King, just like Robert Plant that we did an hour. We don't brush up these people's lives. Why bother? They're not interesting if we do it. And great writers don't do it anyway, and that's what makes Chernow so brilliant. You're reading the life of Alexander Hamilton, and it is messy. And boy, one minute you love him, and the next minute you're going, what a jerk. And then you come back to loving him, and then you come back to hating him, and you see this incredible talent. and you walk away saying, wow, what this country would have been like without these men. Like them, don't like them. What a story. And one of the books that we've been relying on here at Our American Stories is one called Out Where the West Begins by Phil Anschutz. And we've already done the life of Levi Strauss, the life of Adolf Coors. Again, you know these names, Coors Brewing, Levi Jeans. Who were the men who brought us these things that we use, drink, enjoy every day? And under finance, he spent some time on the life of J.P. Morgan. And, of course, we also have The House of Morgan by Ron Chernow, a couple of great documentaries that are out there. And then just searching for other source material, Greg, Alex, Jesse, John, the whole team here works to bring you these hours, and they just do a terrific, terrific job. And all of this is brought to you, of course, by Hillsdale College. And now we return to the final installment of this life, this rich life, this complicated life, and this showdown between two giants, J.P. Morgan and Teddy Roosevelt.
Morgan was prosecuted for breach of the Antitrust Act and lost in a 5-4 decision at the U.S. Supreme Court in 1903. Then, in the fall of 1907, another panic hit Wall Street. One of America's largest trust companies had collapsed, sending shockwaves throughout the American economy. Immediate action was required, and President Roosevelt's advisors knew that there was only one man with the power to save the nation.
Morgan's reach was very broad in American industry. He becomes the most respected, reliable, and trusted figure, not only because of the power and wealth that he wields, but just because of his character.
The president who had prosecuted Morgan for having too much control was about to hand that control back to him. And Morgan had a plan. His answer was to get the larger trusts to invest money in their weaker competitors. This wasn't easy, but Morgan's power of persuasion was unmatched.
Morgan was a very flamboyant and almost operatic figure, and like all great actors, he liked to have great stage sets for his big set pieces. He found that very often, in order to get a business deal, it helped to isolate people and also to set a deadline.
He gathered the trust company presidents in his library. He cast a long, penetrating look at each man and launched into a plea for cooperation that at times sounded more like a command. Morgan then walked to the front door of the library, locked it, and retired to another room to play solitaire. The nation's most influential men were locked in Morgan's library and weren't allowed out until they came up with a solution.
And he would be sitting at the desk and he would be flipping his cards. And one of his lieutenants would come in and say, Mr. Morgan, the bank presidents have proposed a $10 million loan. And he would be flipping his cards and he would look up and he would say, it's not enough. Flick his cards again.
In the early hours of the morning, Morgan marched into the library. The men still had not come to a solution. But Morgan had. He pushed a contract and a pen into the hand of the leader of the trust company presidents. He pointed to the contract and said, here's the place and here's the pen. Completely exhausted and beaten down, the president signed and the others followed. The men agreed to contribute to the $25 million pool to save the weakened trusts. Within days, the economy rallied. Vowing to never let it happen again, and realizing that in a future crisis there was unlikely to be another Morgan, the banking and political leaders devised a plan that resulted in the creation of the Federal Reserve System in 1913. Here's Ron Chernow.
Prior to 1913, we did not have a Federal Reserve Board in this country. We had J. Pierpont Morgan. He was like a one-man central bank.
On the morning of April 15, 1912, Morgan was scheduled to travel on the ill-fated maiden voyage of the RMS Titanic, but canceled at the last minute. The White Star Line, which operated Titanic, was part of Morgan's International Mercantile Marine Company, and Morgan was to have his own private suite and promenade deck on the ship. In response to the sinking of Titanic, Morgan purportedly said, "Monetary losses amount to nothing in life. It is the loss of life that counts. It is that frightful death." On March 31st, 1913, he died in his sleep in a hotel in Rome, just short of his 76th birthday. Thousands of people flocked to St. George's Church for his funeral. As a final tribute, flags on Wall Street flew at half-staff, and in an honor usually reserved for heads of state, the stock market closed for 2 hours when his body passed through New York City, one of the few times in its history. Morgan's son Jack took control of J.P. Morgan & Company. The firm still exists today. Morgan loved his nation, saving it from economic collapse on more than one occasion. He served on the board of New York's St. Luke's Hospital and volunteered his time and skills to the YMCA. He helped found the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Museum of Natural History. He underwrote 3 new buildings for Harvard Medical School. J.P. Morgan was a patriot who believed in American exceptionalism. As he optimistically remarked, "The man who is a bear on the future of the United States will always go broke." Historian H.W. Brands concluded, "He knew railroads as well as William Vanderbilt, steel as well as Andrew Carnegie, and government finance better than President Grover Cleveland." After Morgan's death, his once bitter rival Theodore Roosevelt summed up Morgan's life. "Mr. Morgan was politically opposed to me. Yet whenever I was brought into contact with him, I was struck not only by his very great power, but by his sincerity and truthfulness." J. Pierpont Morgan used his integrity and his influence to transform Wall Street at the turn of the century. In the process, he changed America forever.
And that is just one great piece of storytelling. And again, go to our website on our This Day in History. And again, we want to focus on the businessmen of this country. Too often it's the sport figures or the entertainment figures or the politicians or the generals. But this space of what America would look like without some of these men, and again, like them or not, good guys, bad guys, what did they do? What made them great? And what did they do for their country? What was their contribution in the end? We did an hour on Ray Kroc, and this guy brought us McDonald's, Levi Strauss, the jeans, Hendrick Meyer, the store, same with Sam Walton, Walmart, Adolf Coors. Well, these are the things that we love in life too. And we're going to do much more on Mr. Ranchich's book, Out Where the West Begins, and much more in the area of American business and how businessmen built this great country. As always, all of this is brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. And by the way, if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale can come to you. They're great online courses. And my goodness, the Constitution 101 is worth it by itself. 10 hours of just superb teaching by one of the best faculties in this country. It's available at hillsdale.edu. That's hillsdale.edu. And Our American Stories, Best Day, This Days in History, are available at ouramericannetwork.org. And just imagine that. He purchased that part in the story where he purchased Carnegie Steel, and he gave him the equivalent of $310 billion and told him to go take a walk. But overnight created a company with a stock value of $1.4 billion. And you can like that, you cannot like that, but that is the backbone. American finance is the backbone of this country. Without financial men, without great banks, like them or not like them. My goodness, we're doing a lot of storytelling about Dodd-Frank because there are some excesses. But let me tell you, without great financial prowess, without our markets, without the SEC, America is not America. And I also love what was said about this man. and what this man said about our country. The man who is a bear on America's future will always go broke. And for all the naysayers who've always said our best days are behind us, nonsense. Nonsense. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And this is Our American Stories. And every once in a while, we like to do a live best of. We listen to you. We take your requests. In this first segment, we want to do the funny stuff. We did a profile on Chris Farley. We paid tribute to one of the funniest guys ever on TV. We spent some time hearing some of his family and friends tell their stories. And of course, we heard from Chris Farley himself.
We were probably in fourth grade, and we had a bus that went across town. And he would sing, Jeremiah was a bullfrog. Jeremiah was a bullfrog. And he'd have the whole bus standing up singing it. He took his shirt off for that on the school bus and just sang it in the front.
I liked a girl named Chris Bear. And so he would be in the back of the bus going, Johnny Farley loves Chris Bear naked. Johnny Farley. He got the whole bus to chant it. And I was in the front going, oh, why?
In grade school at St. Patrick's, my mom was in the semicircle with a bunch of nuns around it, and they were saying, you know, the students at school are laughing at Christopher, not with him.
And obviously, Farley's family, a traditional Roman Catholic family, and Irish. From the documentary on the life of Farley, we hear from comedians Bob Saget and Bob Odenkirk about that dark side that Chris had, like so many other funny people, suffer with.
He's a very sweet guy. Before midnight, he was as open and like a six-year-old as he was dark. And the darkness was compelling, but not something you want to really be around.
I got the exact drugs I'm going to do, and then I'm going to get it together, which is just not the way it goes. The way it goes is you get messed up, then you really, you know, you call your buddies.
When you're jumping up steps in the showbiz ladder and you're leaping over everyone around you and everyone around you is going, you better watch out. Some part of you has to be going, no, you better watch out because I'm kicking ass every day.
And here's some classic Chris Farley from SNL in his Matt Foley motivational speaker sketch where he lectures two teenagers played by David Spade and Christina Applegate, after they were caught smoking something funny.
My name is Matt Foley, and I am a motivational speaker. Now let's get started by letting me give you a little bit of a scenario of what my life is all about. First off, I am 35 years old, I am divorced, and I live in a van down by the river. Now, you kids are probably saying to yourselves, hey, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get the world by the tail and wrap it around and pull it down and put it in my pocket. Well, I'm here to tell you that you're probably going to find out as you go out there that you're not going to amount to jack squat.
And that's what made Chris Farley, Chris Farley. Now on to Steve Martin. Good guy comedy, we call it. We take a look at this comedian, actor, producer, writer, musician, magician, who carries the unusual trait of not using anger or expletives as the driving force behind his comedy. Born Standing Up, A Comic's Life is a memoir released by Martin back in 2007. It chronicles his early life, his days working for Disneyland in the Magic Shop, working at coffee shops and clubs as a comedy act, his relationships, his eventual fame, and the reason why he quit stand-up comedy at the height of his fame in 1981. In this clip, we hear a portion of this fascinating look into the mind of a comic genius, read by Martin himself from his own audiobook. It starts with Steve's nonconformist chant.
And now, let's repeat the nonconformist oath. I promise to be different. I promise to be unique.
I promise to be unique.
I promise not to repeat things other people say.
I did stand-up comedy for 18 years. 10 of those years were spent learning, 4 years were spent refining, and 4 were spent in wild success. My most persistent memory of stand-up is of my mouth being in the present and my mind being in the future. The mouth speaking the line, the body delivering the gesture, while the mind looks back, observing, analyzing, judging, worrying, and then deciding when and what to say next. Enjoyment while performing was rare. Enjoyment would have been an indulgent loss of focus that comedy cannot afford. After the shows, however, I experienced long hours of elation or misery, depending on how the show went, because doing comedy alone on stage is the ego's last stand. My decade is the 70s, with several years extending on either side. Though my general recall of the period is precise, my memory of specific shows is faint. I stood on stage, blinded by lights, looking into blackness, which made every place the same. Darkness is essential. If light is thrown on the audience, they don't laugh. I might as well have told them to sit still and be quiet. The audience necessarily remained a thing unseen, except for a few front rows, where one sourpuss could send me into panic and desperation. The comedian's slang for a successful show is, I murdered them, which I'm sure came about because you finally realize that the audience is capable of murdering you. Stand-up is seldom performed in ideal circumstances. Comedy's enemy is distraction, and rarely do comedians get a pristine performing environment. I worried about the sound system, ambient noise, hecklers, drunks, lighting, sudden clangs, latecomers, and loud talkers, and not to mention the nagging concern, is this funny? Yet the seedier the circumstances, the funnier one can be. I suppose these worries keep the mind sharp and the senses active. I can remember instantly retiming a punchline to fit around the crash of a dropped glass of wine, or raising my voice to cover a patron's ill-timed sneeze, seemingly microseconds before the interruption happened. I was seeking comic originality, and fame fell on me as a byproduct. The course was more plodding than heroic. I did not strive valiantly against doubters, but took incremental steps studded with a few intuitive leaps. I was not naturally talented. I didn't sing, dance, or act, though working around that minor detail made me inventive. I was not self-destructive, though I almost destroyed myself. In the end, I turned away from stand-up with a tired swivel of my head and never looked back until now. A few years ago, I began researching and recalling the details of this crucial part of my professional life, which inevitably touches upon my personal life, and was reminded why I did stand up and why I walked away.
And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More of our best ofs after these messages. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And one of our favorite segments occurs almost every week with the Wall Street Journal's Heidi Mitchell. The folks over there at the Wall Street Journal sit around and they put together a burning question of the week. And they're often silly, almost always lighthearted. And on this particular week, well, we took a real interest. Can kissing your dog make you sick? And I got to tell you, I can't wait to hear the answer to this one, Heidi. Thanks for joining us.
Important journalism being done on kissing your dog.
Let me tell you why it's important, Heidi. Stuff. I'll tell you a story. I'm away at my family farm. We do this every few weeks, and we get together with cousins and relatives, and we just do nothing. There's not even cell coverage at this farm in the middle of Mississippi. And I'm watching my little pug go out into the stable where the horses are, and he sleeps with us every night, and he started to eat the horse poop. You smell what I'm cooking, Heidi? So let's talk about this, because this is an important question. How did you get to this, by the way? How did you get to this question this week? Why this question?
Well, this was one of those questions that someone in the office asked because she loved her dog, and she lets the dog kiss her all over the place. But, you know, we live in the city, most of us, and so there's a lot of icky stuff that the dogs are picking up. But I have to say, it's something like 6% of dogs eat bears or other animal species. So it's not so rare what your dog's doing in the barn there.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
I don't feel so alone. So tell me, what's going on inside that dog's mouth? I mean, I've always heard the dog's mouth is the cleanest place in the world. They have special bacteria, and no matter what they eat, all's just dandy. Talk about that.
Well, the thing is that their mouths are special. You know, they've evolved with all this yucky stuff in there, and it doesn't make them sick for the most part, right? I mean, most dogs are pretty healthy, happy,
yep,
loving animals and part of the family. And what they carry in their saliva is a lot of bugs. They carry a lot of stuff in there. There's some stuff that isn't going to be harmful to humans. There's some stuff that isn't going to be harmful to them. And then there's the stuff that ain't so great. And those are the things that doctors worry about.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you talk to someone named Dr. Sykes, the interim director of the Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital at UC Davis. And this is where the journalism comes in, because you've got this burning question that may seem silly, but it leads you down some pretty interesting paths. So what do you learn about...
Oh, it's amazing, because there's experts in everything.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
They devote their whole lives to studying these things.
Well, it's good to know that this doesn't make our dog sick, but the question becomes, does it make us sick? So what does he have to tell us, Dr. Sykes, about your burning question?
So it's a she, but she has lots to say about it. So the most crucial things you need to think about are Campylobacter, which is a food poisoning agent, Giardia, which can cause diarrhea, you probably heard of Giardia, and Salmonella, which is, you know, an organism that affects the gut and makes you have to take a couple days off work or at least not be in public for very long. And all those are just stomach ailments. They're really not, probably not going to kill you. They might cause dehydration and lots of diarrhea and pain in the gut. But if your dog is licking you all over your face and getting that saliva in your mouth, you know, you can catch that stuff. But it can get worse than that.
Well, there you go. And that's why we love doing that segment with Heidi Mitchell. You learn stuff, even stuff you might not want to learn. And it's always amusing. And then periodically we dig into the American dream and a story, a life story that we think is worthy of an hour. And on this particular occasion, we spent an hour on the life of Mario Andretti, who we learned he overcame tremendous circumstances, having grown up in Italy and spent some time under some very rough political circumstances. And so we picked this up in the second segment of this hour-long story. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to catch the full hour. Let's take a listen. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Mario Andretti. And when we left off, we learned that after getting through World War II, living through all the conflict that occurred in Italy, we were a part of the war. This was a difficult theater, especially southern Italy, Mussolini. And then entering displaced person camp because the family farm was stolen from them when Yugoslavia merged with that part of Italy and took over their farm. Mario says that despite the conditions, they found some hope in the form of an auto racing idol, Alberto Ascari, as I mentioned earlier. In 1954, they went to the Italian Grand Prix to see their idol, and it changed everything.
Probably the most important event as far as my formative years, as far as defining something for me. It's hard to explain. It's almost impossible for me to explain what I really was feeling in those days. I mean, I had such a draw to something like that. I mean, I don't think there was anything else in life that you could have presented to me in any possible way to say, this could be better. This is it. I mean, this gave me the definite, as Alberto Ascari, that's what gave me the definite direction, the focus, and I said, this guy here again, you know, Ascari as a figure represented, you know, the true, you know, the hero, what someone that I admire so much. I mean, he had his heart hanging right out in front of him. And again, like I said, it goes back where how much even kids, you know, I was 14 years old, you could see this thing, you could see that effort, you know, on the part of Ascari. I said, oh, man, there's a guy, I mean, there's a fighter, you know. And so that's the inspiration, you know, that it was so clear.
And that's what fueled young Mario. And it turns out his family, well, they needed to get out of Europe and out of Italy, and they had one place they could go. They had some family members in Pennsylvania, a small town called Nazareth. And they waited 3 years for a visa and finally got there. The boys, of course, wanted to just stay there. Who wants to move to a foreign land, learn a new language? But the family, the dad, knew what was best. And so they arrive, and Mario says that it was a strange new land, but they had some really good luck. It was a racetrack right near home.
What looked good about it was that it looked unsophisticated, so because of that, it looked very approachable. I said, you know what? You know, when we saw Monza, I mean, it looked like, okay, we were there, you know, but we were 20 million miles away from reality. Here, it looked like, you know what, we could pursue this.
And that was his point, you know, the world of Monza and Formula One, these were peasants. How were they ever going to get there? But this was a dirt track. And these were guys just rigging up their own cars and driving around in circles for prize money they probably kicked in with a couple of local sponsors. And so what do? They build their first race car, the brothers, without, by the way, the dad's permission. The dad was frowned upon this. But the boys bought a 1948 Hudson Hornet. And in March 1959, the Andretti twins were ready to race. With only one helmet, one car, there had to be a coin toss. Aldo won it, and he became the driver. And because it was their very first race, he started last, 26th in a field of 26. And again, they raced without their father's consent. Indeed, their dad forbade it. Then came, after a victory or two, a tragic accident.
And all of a sudden, I look on the back straightaway coming out of turn two.
And I hit the fence, caught one of the wheels, and that thing flipped for, you know, for a long time.
I mean, that car just went end over end.
It must have knocked me out very early because I don't remember anything. I remember just losing the car.
Immediately he was in a coma and taken to the hospital. He was, you know, he was given his last rites. I mean, he was breathing and he was totally out. The next morning, the doctor said, we need the boy's parents here. We'll call the police. So, you know, of course, you know, I had to face the music, and I felt like a criminal, you know, that for not telling them. But I had a sense of relief at the same time, too, you know, that, okay, now he knows, okay, you know, what can he do? Just beat me to death or something, you know.
And there you have it. That was just a part of that piece. And go to the website, again, OurAmericanNetwork.org, Andretti's life. And by the way, you didn't hear it, but he had grown up in Italy, and Mussolini took over. The family owned a vineyard. That didn't end well. Then they got it back. But then Yugoslavia came in, captured that part of Italy, and the communists took the family vineyard. The family lived in a displaced persons camp in northern Italy for 7 years in one room. Came to Pennsylvania, and from that, with a dirt car, they built a racing empire. Aldo, by the way, recovered, just in case you're worried, his brother. But Aldo's misfortune became Mario's opportunity, and he did not waste it. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More of our Best of Hour right after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We spend some time actually on prison stories, and particularly prison ministry stories and prison reform. And we talked to someone named David Ray, a guy who had gotten a life sentence, but ended up in a prison ministry program by the Urban Ministry Institute, funded by, in part, B. Wayne Hughes, a billionaire in Southern California who has a heart for guys stuck on the wrong side of the tracks, and he wants to change their lives. Let's pick up our conversation with David Ray. Some people listening are thinking, you know, you were supposed to be sentenced to a life prison sentence, and you're now free, and how the heck did that happen? And listeners might be wondering, David, should you be free? Talk to those people listening and answer both of those questions to them if you could.
Well, if you're wondering how I'm free, it's by the power of Christ that I'm free. He's the only one that can change a man. He's the only one that can change a system. He's the only one that can get through when no one else can. And when I went into prison, the only way you were paroling was in a pine box. That being said, to those of you that think that somebody like me should still be in there, I wouldn't argue with you. Should I be in there? I mean, I killed a man. If somebody killed my family member, I would probably never want that person out, right? Because I'd be angry, a lot of things. I can't justify my freedom. Only Christ can. And if Christ can redeem me and say that I'm still useful and still put me to work out here so I can stop your kids from joining gangs, because I work with the Sacramento PD in gang prevention. I'm learning how to do that. I help people in reentry to stop using drugs, to get their life on track, to give them counseling, to give them coaching, to give them skills that they were never given so they don't end up in prison for committing murder or for selling drugs or for pimping a girl or anything that gang members do, right? We don't want to keep that going. So what people need to hear out here is from people like me, they're going to shatter the glorification of a gang lifestyle and a drug lifestyle that our kids think is the coolest thing ever, and they can't wait to go to prison and hang out with the homies and do this and do that. I want to shatter that image because that image is false. It sucks to be in prison and all of that, everything that comes with that lifestyle. And if I can change people's lives out here, because I am, let me tell you, I am making a difference. I impact my community every day. I shape my environment. My environment doesn't shape me. And by me doing that, you may think I should be in prison, but you want to pay tax dollars to keep me in prison and everybody that I stop going from prison? Because just because I'm out here, right, you're saving I don't know how many thousands of dollars because you're not paying for me to be locked up anymore. But you're also saving money in every life I change, in every life I touch, in every life I impact and change the way that they're going, because that's what I do.
That was very powerful. And by the way, the Urban Ministry Institute's numbers are unbelievable. Recidivism rates go from 54% to 2.5%. It's in 22 prisons, and they've had 1,250 graduates, 1,250 lives changed at least. From the serious to the sublime, we spent an hour on Johnny Carson's life, and what we learned was he was extremely generous to comics. We learned it from everybody. And here is a sample. Here is Jerry Seinfeld performing his first time ever. Listen to Johnny Carson in the background, and then listen to Rodney Dangerfield.
My folks are moving to Florida. They don't want to move to Florida, but they're in their 60s, and that's the law.
Long Island. I think you evicted from Long Island, aren't you, 60?
They have like a leisure police of some kind. Get the golf clubs, get in the van, folks. You know.
Listen to Carson laughing. See, the thing is, he wanted his guys to do great when they appeared. Some stars don't want to see the people sitting next to him do better than them. This was the key to Carson. Leno couldn't replicate this. Letterman couldn't replicate this because their egos were too big. Colbert, Stewart, loved them, but they never made their guests funnier. And this is why none of them held a candle to Carson. And they all looked up to Carson as a genius, but didn't quite understand the reason he was. Want to play a clip now, and Carson was so generous with this guy. Every time he came on, Carson would just set him up and set him up and set him up. And it's the one and only Rodney Dangerfield.
Smoking, that's another one. Yeah. Try to stop smoking. That's a beauty, huh? Well, with cigarettes, my wife and I, we made a deal, my wife and I. We only smoke after sex. I got the same pack now since 1975. What bothers me is my wife. She's up to 3 packs a day. Oh. tell you the truth, and my wife and I, we never have sex. Now, we get undressed, we can't stop laughing, you know? But I'll tell you one thing, when my wife does have sex, she screams. Ooh, especially when I walk in on her. Ooh.
And there you have it, Johnny Carson making everybody shine. And another part of our programming that we love is talking to great writers. And Greg Ipp is the Wall Street Journal's chief economics commentator. And his book about danger and risk was terrific. And we focused on one chapter, More Risk, Please. Let's hear from Greg and I. Greg, we're hearing so much. Look, there's a Will Smith movie that came out not too long ago. But why in the world would anybody want to take more risk or have their kids play football, for instance? Let's look at the NFL first. Tell us this story.
So I don't think anybody intends to take more risk, but what I'm trying to do here is talk about how things that we do to protect ourselves may actually encourage us to take more risk because we feel safer when we do that. And I think football helmets are a good example of this. You know, people started playing football in the 1800s, and look, it was a violent sport. In the early 1900s, there was a famous meeting between President Theodore Roosevelt and the college presidents where he said, look, you got to clean up this game or I'm just going to stop it altogether. So they started wearing more padding, and by the 40s, they'd introduced hard helmets. What the coaches noticed when their kids played these hard helmets is that it made them much more effective if they put their head down as a defensive player to tackle the offensive player. So they teach the kids to spear each other. But what this did was it loaded all this pressure on the spinal column. And so in the years after the introduction of these helmets, you saw a really troubling increase in spinal injuries and quadriplegias and so forth. So the perfect example of the greater sense of safety that comes from a protective device actually encouraging risky behavior that actually ended up doing other types of harm.
You know, a few days, Mike Ditka, former coach of the Chicago Bears, offered up his own remedy. And he said, quote, I don't think people would strike with a head nearly as much if you didn't have a helmet on your head. You would learn how to strike with a thing called your shoulder pads. And Mike Ditka, by the way, was one of the toughest old school players, along with guys like Dick Butkus and Ray Nitschke. I mean, these guys played back when there were barely helmets.
Well, you're right. And in fact, a lot of football players agree with him. They say, you know, the helmet encourages me to use my head and to hit with more force or to hit more often. There's an interesting experiment that was done by a professor at the University of New Hampshire, where he basically asked 25 kids, college players, to practice for a few minutes every week without their helmets on. And then 25 kids were the control group, and they would continue to practice with the helmets on. Then he sent them out to play, and then he measured how often they hit their heads. And he found that the kids who had practiced more often without the helmets on were suffered fewer head impacts during the game, even though they were now wearing their helmets. And his conclusion was that the habit of playing without the helmet taught them to protect their heads better. Now, I don't think anybody's going to go as far as Ditka says and get rid of the helmets altogether, because used properly, the helmet does help. The problem with the concussion, of course, is that even wearing the helmet, well, the helmet protects you against like a head fracture. It doesn't necessarily protect you against a concussion, which comes when the head comes to a halt very suddenly and the brain keeps moving in the skull. The helmet provides some protection from that, but not full protection. And if the helmet gives the player the feeling that he's much more protected than before, he, again, might be hitting his head more often, and that could actually increase the risk of concussion. So it's very important to sort of look at these ways to sort of teach the kids not to let themselves be fooled into thinking that their head is somehow more useful as a battering ram just because they've got this amazing piece of technology on it.
And there you have it. Everything from the Wall Street Journal's economics editor to Johnny Carson to us hearing directly from a prisoner who came out of one of the great ministries in America. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. George Washington's first State of the Union, the life of Chuck Jones, and just the guys goofing off. More after these messages. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. I want to first start with George Washington's first State of the Union. And this is me setting things up. You might be surprised what his speech focuses on and how short it was. And today these are hour-long affairs, hyped by the media, but then, well, a very different thing. Article 2, Section 3, Clause 1 of the Constitution states that the President shall, quote, from time to time give to the Congress information on the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. Arriving by horse-drawn carriage on a cold January morning, the President spoke in the Senate chamber of Federal Hall in New York City. He used the short speech to contend that it's vital to have a citizenry that knows and values, quote, their own rights, and is able to, quote, discriminate the spirit of liberty from that of licentiousness. But most of all, he used the speech to highlight the importance of a professional army to ensure national security. Here is that part of his State of the Union address.
Fellow citizens of the Senate and House of Representatives, among the many interesting objects which will engage your attention, that of providing for the common defense will merit particular regard. To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving peace. A free people ought not only to be armed, but disciplined, to which end a uniform and well-digested plan is requisite. And their safety and interest require that they should promote such manufactories as tend to render them independent of others for essential, particularly military, supplies. The proper establishment of the troops, which may be deemed indispensable, will be entitled to mature consideration. In the arrangements which may be made respecting it, will be of importance to conciliate the comfortable support of the officers and soldiers with a due regard to economy.
And this was a very, very short speech by any modern standards. And by the way, so too was Lincoln's, if you remember. The Gettysburg Address was 287 words. Washington set the precedent of delivering a formal address, by the way, though President Thomas Jefferson ended the practice of personally delivering a speech before Congress until Woodrow Wilson resurrected it in 1913. And that's our This Day in History, which is brought to you and to us by Hillsdale College. The next story up, the amazing life of Chuck Jones, the Looney Tunes animator and creator. In this clip, we learned about Chuck's work ethic, and we listened to some classic Bugs Bunny. Chuck was coming out of art school right in 1931, in the worst of the Great Depression. Chuck said, quote, to expect to get a job when 3 out of every 10 people were unemployed was ridiculous, particularly for a kid without any experience in anything. I had worked my way through art school by being a janitor, but I never worked full-time as a janitor, and I wasn't sure I was capable. I was certainly willing. And to the willing came the treasure. Someone offered to pay him to do his, well, to do his thing and draw. He told the Academy of Achievement that he couldn't believe it.
I was still astonished that somebody would offer me a job and pay me to do what I wanted to do. And to this day, that's been the astonishment of my life and delight of my life and the wonder of my life and the puzzlement that anybody would be so stupid as to be willing to do that.
Talk about humility. Jones, humble and focused. So focused that years later, when he was offered an opportunity to be the boss, a studio bigwig, he said no. He told the Academy of Achievement that he wasn't going to trade his tools, his passion, for a big desk and more money.
And I hear all these success stories of people, you know, these captains of industry and so on, these forgers of the world and empire builders and so on. And they talk about, you know, all the money they made and, you know, become presidents and all that. And I thought, geez, but look at me. When I was offered a chance to be head of studios, I wouldn't take it. I like to work with the tools of my trade, and the tools of my trade is a lot of paper and a pencil, and that's all it is.
A lot of paper and a pencil. That's all it is. And luckily for Chuck, he had the kind of parents who just let him be. Let him do it. You'd say that right now to a parent? I want to draw. Well, good luck with that. Good luck with that. And let's hear a little bit more. Let's hear Elmer, Daffy, and Bugs.
Now it's duck hunting season. That, sir, is an investigated fabrication. It's wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. I say it's duck season, and I say fire. Let's try that again. Okay, I'll start it this time. Right. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Fire!
And we know
it goes backwards.
As Bill goes backwards, and we know we don't even have to see it. We've seen it 100 times, and it doesn't matter how many times you watch it or hear it, you still laugh. It's
still funny.
It's still funny. And last but not least, the boys, well, we like to get around the microphone and just talk about, well, what we always talk about, food and movies and sports sometimes, but mostly food, second movies, and combine the two, and this is what you get. We were just goofing off talking about our favorite scenes about food and movies and TV. And, well, one of them, well, it was Pulp Fiction. Sam Jackson and John Travolta talking about, of all things important, hamburgers.
You know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese? What do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. Classic. That's right, Jesse. Seinfeld, our favorite scene there was the infamous double dip scene with George at a party. And let's take a listen.
What are you doing? What? Did you just double dip that shit?
Excuse me?
You double dipped the chip.
Double dipped? What are you talking about?
You dipped the chip. You took a bite. And you dipped again.
So?
That's like putting your whole mouth right in the dip. Look, from now on, when you take a chip, just take one dip and end it.
Well, I'm sorry, Timmy.
But I don't dip that way. Oh, you don't, huh?
No. You dip the way you want to dip. I'll dip the way I want to dip.
Give me the chip!
Hey!
I agree with the dip Nazi, though. I mean, come on, really.
He's right. I love the way that guy sold it, too. Yeah. He was so serious.
His fingers, when he's like, we need to pounce.
Oh, and of course, our favorite, it was just not even a consideration. It's, of course, from Goodfellas, and it's the prison eating scene.
Goodfellas.
Yeah, fellows?
Sorry, Goodfellas. I'm from Jersey.
It's okay off the air, but on the air, you got to say it correctly.
Goodfellas. And Ray Liotta doing the voiceover work. Here we go.
In prison, dinner was always a big thing. Paulie did the prep work. He was doing a year for contempt, and he had this wonderful system for doing the garlic. He used a razor and he used to slice it so thin that it used to liquefy in the pan with just a little oil. It's a very good system. Vinny was in charge of the tomato sauce.
Ah, got the smell.
But three kinds of meat in the meatballs.
You got
veal, beef, and pork.
Ah, good, but you gotta have the pork.
That's the flavor.
I felt he used too many onions, but it was still a very good sauce.
Vinny, don't put too many onions in the sauce.
I didn't put too much onions. Three small onions, that's all I did.
Three onions? How many cans of tomatoes you put in there?
I put two big cans.
You don't need three onions.
Johnny Dio did the meat. We didn't have a broiler, so Johnny did everything in pans. I used to smell up the joint something awful, and the hacks used to die, but he still cooked a great steak.
Hey, how do you like yours?
Medium rare.
Hmm, an aristocrat.
Yeah, it doesn't get better.
You're gonna have
to
watch that again.
I know.
Yeah,
it's on like every week with Godfather. I think it's like 8 hours a week on AMC.
I'll tell you, I bumped into the guy who said not so much onions. Paul Servino.
Yep.
I was at a high school volleyball game in Malibu. His granddaughter was playing, and I barely recognized him. Because there's a story. He says, when I was preparing for this role, I had to get in a state of mind. He says, one day I was walking by a mirror, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I flinched because it was some other guy. It was some dark, evil guy.
Right.
And so when I saw him at the game, it was true. It was that softness on his face. There was not that edge that was in the movie. It was crazy.
That's great acting.
And that is great acting. Paul Servino, one of the great supporting actors in every mob film you've ever seen. This is Lee Habib, the best of Our American Stories live. Every once in a while, we like to do that for you. Take the best of our crew and share it with you. Again, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to catch all of this.